ऐसी मशीन लगाऊंगा, इस साइड से आलू घुसेगा, उस साइड से सोना निकलेगा।
Welcome to the Attention Please podcast, now on video. If you like this podcast, kindly like, share, subscribe. You know what to do. So this is the 150th episode of the Attention Please podcast. Wow. It's been a journey. And it also happens to be my birthday episode, which is something which I do every year, December 30 being my birthday. So this is the day on which I ask people to send in questions on Twitter. Using the hashtag AskArnabRay, not AskArnab, because that inevitably, there's a lot of people asking questions of Arnab Goswami, and Twitter is one of the places where they can ask him without being shouted at, because Arnab Goswami is not on Twitter, and I am not Arnab Goswami. So I'm going to start off. I have another phone here, and so I'll be scrolling down the questions which have been tagged with hashtag AskArnab. So when my eyes move, that's what it is. And the reason why I have to say this is I get a lot of criticism. More than the content, it's like your face is too close, or you know, your eyes were not on the screen. And so I understand that my face being close to the camera might be very, you know, it might be like a close up with Godzilla. So let me just apologize beforehand. I don't edit the video, so everything is as it is. So let's go. So one of the first questions that I got was from Vikram Kadi. And I might miss your name sometimes because I don't know whether I'm supposed to say it, but I know Vikram. So he said that, Dada, my question got lost last year due to a last minute change in hashtag. It's still the same. What is the best and worst thing about living in California? So there are a lot of worst things. I think that, and I can't grade them in terms of which is worse, earthquakes, fires, high taxes, insane traffic. Did I say high taxes? Yes, high taxes. So there's a lot of bad things about living in California. And I said this before, I don't enjoy doing so, but I have to because where I work doesn't allow remote work. So I have to be where I work. What's the best thing about California? Honestly, I don't know. When I ask myself that question, what I usually tell myself is that, look, we have the Hollywood elite staying here and we have the Silicon Valley elite staying in California. So they could be anywhere in the world, but they choose to stay here, unlike me. So maybe there's something great about this place that I just don't managed to see, and maybe I will see it one day, but I'm not there yet. So that's really the best thing about California. There is something there that I'm yet to discover. But for now, no, it's not for me. The next question is from the Pelican Club, and it's asked me for best graphic novels, anthology, omnibus recommendations. Now, I'm trying not to answer these kinds of questions because what usually happens, so there are several questions on the best movies of this year, books you've read, because you know, there's always an immediacy bias. So everything that I read just before is either great or terrible. So, and I tend to forget things that I have read a few months ago. Put it down to advanced stage. But in terms of best graphic novels, obviously the Sandman series comes to mind. I have gone through 3 books. They're wildly imaginative, but sometimes I think a little bit too much imaginative for my liking. But it's obviously definitely worth reading. I would say Watchmen. It's something which I've enjoyed and I've read multiple times. It's just brilliant. It's brilliantly drawn. The story is great. And it's kind of reinvented the superhero genre in my opinion. And obviously it's a classic. So I would definitely recommend those too. Then the next question I see is a very concrete question. One, when will your next book be out? So my next book, I'm not sure if it will be out next year. Let's see. My next book will most probably be Shakyamuni. Again, it depends on, you know, how, what's the venue and what's the avenue by which I can get it published. So that's, I'm almost like 50% done with writing Shak Chunni. So I don't think it's going to take me a lot of time to write it once it's done. For those of you who don't know, I wrote a book this year. It was a cybersecurity book and it came out in November. And I basically stopped writing fiction for the last 3 years. I've kind of taken it up again. The next question is there any progress on Sultan of Delhi Part 2? I haven't written Sultan of Delhi Part 2 for years now. So no, there's no progress. It's about 50. Again, it's also another project which is 50% done, installed. And the reason why I haven't been able to get into it is, you know, reasons that I've talked about before. Keeping my fingers crossed for some developments next year. Once that happens, maybe I will take up Sultan of Delhi Part 2. But for now, and the reason why Sultan of Delhi Part 2, I've kind of been hesitant getting back to it. Its publication fate depends on Sultan of Delhi Part 1 in a way. Nobody's going to publish it without Part 1. So that's kind of why I've dithered on writing Sultan of Delhi Part 2. It's something which I enormously enjoy writing, though, because I love the characters. But again, I don't think there will be any Sultan of Delhi Part 2 coming out next year. Shak Chunni is most likely to be the book that would be published next year. And the second question, your take on recent captaincy changes in Indian cricket and alleged feud between Kohli and Virat. I'm guessing this is from the Wolfbean. I'm guessing this is a typo, unless there is some kind of Karthik calling Karthik going on. Between Kohli and Virat. I've already made my comments on Twitter and have been endlessly trolled by Virat Kohli's troll army as a result of that, including people taking my pictures and photoshopping them, putting like a target on them with crosses and circles. So my opinion on Virat Kohli and the captaincy feud is kind of well known, but I'll just summarize it. I think that between Ganguly and Virat Kohli, none of them came out looking good. I think Ganguly has always had a problem. He's a good on-field captain, but I've never been really impressed with his off-field handling of crisis, whether it be the John Buchanan episode or the Greg Chappell episode. And it came out again here. This could have been much better handled from Ganguly's side. And from Virat Kohli's side, my expectations of him, other than as a batsman, and even that has been going down, it's never been particularly high. So nothing really surprising here. The next question is from Kanad Basu, and he asks me, why are you not interested in football as much as cricket? I did start off, I used to like watching football at one point of time, essentially because there was not much to do. But my first love has always been cricket. And over the years when, you know, there are just so many more things to do, football has been one of the things that I've kind of let go. It's because I was never really passionately into it. One reason was my exposure to football was Mohun Bagan, East Bengal, and the quality of the game then. And you couldn't get, when I was growing up, you couldn't get, live soccer feeds from Europe. There used to be I've forgotten what the name of the program was, but PK Banerjee used to have a program where he would, every week, which I would watch, of course, where he would, it was one game from the Italian league. Remember, he used to call AC Milan versus Inter Milan as Dui Milan Air Milan. So I used to watch that at point of time. I always used to follow World Cup soccer, and I still do. But that's about it. Because of the rather poor quality of Maidan football, and I'll have to say it, never considered it seriously. And then you looked at World Cup soccer, and the difference in standards was just so obvious. And somehow I could never get into supporting a club with which I otherwise had no connect. I don't understand how people can do it. Why would I support Liverpool or why would I support Manchester United? I just don't get it because I'm not there. I don't have any connect with these clubs or with their culture. So I've And I do support Kolkata Knight Riders just because they have the rights to my city. It's not that I connect with the culture or the philosophy of the organization in any way. But still, they do have the name of my city, and that's why I find myself supporting them. Though every year I tell myself this is the last year. Hopefully this is the last year for me and Kolkata Knight Riders. So the next question from Shandipan Mitro, he says, as a Shah Rukh fan, do you want Shah Rukh Khan to Harkar Bhi Jeetega in the Aryan Khan episode? If so, how? The Aryan Khan episode, I think, ultimately is going to play out well for Aryan Khan. As Salman Khan has proven, this is something which ties Salman Khan and the Congress party, is that once you go to jail, you have a very successful career. So I think this, Star Kids are launched in different ways. And I think this was unintentionally a great launching platform for Aryan Khan. I think he's going to step into that bad boy shoes, and everybody likes a bad boy, or at least they used to. So I think this was good. And even from the very beginning, it was very obvious that, you know, come on, you know, rich kids do this. This is not a question of justification, you know, they're never going to be able to prove it. This was mostly a spectacle for the consumption for television channels, and that's what it was. And I think that at the end, it brought Aryan Khan as a conversation piece in living rooms. Shah Rukh Khan fans would say that they didn't need it, that he's a star anyways. But I think that overall, this will help him rather than hurt him. So I think that Shah Rukh Khan already har ke jeet gaya hai. The next question is from Skeptical Indian. Your views on people who never get excited for their own birthdays but have to play along for happiness of others. I really can't understand this because I'm always very excited about my birthdays. Because it's all about me, 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 me. Well, I think we should celebrate our birthdays. I think it's important. And I'm not, you know, this might sound like a little bit of a LinkedIn status, but it's important to celebrate ourselves. It's important because nobody else will really. Nobody else really, really, really cares about you as much as you do. So I think this is a good day. You can celebrate it any day. I mean, there's nothing special about the day you were born. But, you know, it's a convenient signpost in our lives. And for me, it's not just a question of feeling excited about it. Sometimes I've felt very depressed on my birthdays too, because you kind of look back at the year, you kind of look back at the life, you look at opportunities missed, you know, forks in the road that you didn't take. So it's not all, you know, roses and chocolates, but it's definitely a day for me. I look forward to my birthday. And some people say, you know, when they do say it, I'm not just saying this, you say, you know, when will I outgrow my fascination with my own birthday? And I don't think I will, because I think nobody should, because it's important. I don't think that you should expect other people to consider your birthday to be important. I think that's important. I think growing up means that. And when I was a kid, I used to think that this was an event which was special for everyone. It was special for my parents, of course. I think it still is. But other than you and your parents, I don't think it's really special for anybody else. I mean, it could be, but you shouldn't expect it. And that's really the lesson that I carry from my birthday. The next question is, hold on. Do you ever consider moving back to India? Well, I think I've answered this question before, but I'll answer it again. Is that I did at one point of time about 4 or 5 years ago when I was seriously trying for employment in India. I was trying to... And as you may or may not know, my day job is in cybersecurity. So I am passionate about teaching. I'm passionate about, you know, creating programs. You know, creating, it's not just a question of writing code. That's never been something which I am passionate about. But it's more about creating frameworks, you know, doing something that other people can then execute on in a scalable way. I've always been excited by that. And so I tried about... You know, when my daughter was born, I was kind of she was just like 1 or 2 years old. And there was a window of opportunity where I could definitely move back to India because my daughter was too young and she wouldn't have grown up here. And that's why I also felt that this was the time. This was possibly the last window that I would get to move back to India. And I applied to several places. And would be too detailed to get into this because I have so many questions. But there was, let's just say, there was no interest in what I was trying to sell in terms of cybersecurity in India. There was just almost a, what I found even in some of the most premium institutes was almost a, you know, very lackadaisical attitude towards cybersecurity, kind of like a technical thing. Oh, you know, it's not a big deal. It's not a problem. Huh? What can I say? The next question is from Sam, and he says, as a parent, how do you remain objective to your kids' strengths and weaknesses? It's a very difficult question to answer. It's almost like, it's almost a parenting book here. But if I could summarize, if I could be brief about, concise about it, I would say that, again, it's pause and reflect. You try not to, this is a very fine line. You don't want to come across to your children because you, to your children, you are the world. They, and again, the older they get, you're no longer going to be their world. But my daughter, at her age, me and my wife, we are her world. So if we do not approve of what she's doing, if we do not encourage her, then it's very difficult for her to feel validated. Most of the things that we do, even as adults, we are seeking validation. Whether I'm making this YouTube video right now and I'm asking for likes and shares and subscribes, I'm looking for validation, right? I'm looking for validation not from my parents anymore, but from the world at large. Whether it is, you know, LinkedIn posting or whether it, you know, your daily work activities. If there is no validation, people don't work for a salary. Your salary, they pay you, it goes into the bank, you don't even notice it. But it's daily validation. And if you're not validated, if you feel bullied at work, that's when you quit. So it's very important for us to understand that it's, you are your child's world. And so it's very important for you to convey to your child that you're doing a good job. And I know that there's a pushback. I mean, there was a time when we were growing up where it was mostly that you don't tell your children anything good about themselves, that you, whatever you think, you keep to yourselves. And now we have another extreme where everybody gets a trophy. And so it's difficult to walk this line. For me, the way I, and I know this answer has gone on a bit long, the way I try to remain objective is essentially to benchmark my child against everybody else. Again, it's not something which I tell you her, but what I try to see is, okay, what I want her to do at this stage of life isn't so much, are you great at this, are you not great at this, but for her to explore everything. And strengths and weaknesses will manifest, I think, later in life. Right now, the main thing is to see what she is good at, for her to discover and for me to discover what she's good at. And I've seen there are some things which she's very good at, some things she's okay at, and some things she's not good at. So I think till somebody is a teenager, I think the parents' focus should be on essentially exposing their child to different things. You know, music, art, science, everything. Everything that you can, physical exercise. Everybody has to maintain a base level of everything moving forward. But you know, not everybody is going to be a sportsman. Not everybody is going to be an artist. But doesn't mean that they should not be exposed to that. So that's for me, that's really the answer. Strengths and weaknesses, I think ultimately it will manifest itself at some point of time. My parents know my strengths and weaknesses. They know me very well. But it's, I guess I would say it's still taken them a lot of time to understand that. Again, a question from Sid Roy Chaudhary about Kohli. Not going to discuss that anymore. Two, what do you think is the future of US? Do you think it will last another 100 years without at least some states seceding? No, I don't think states will secede in the US because no matter what people say that it's a divided country between red and blue states, it's still a Christian majoritarian country, no matter how you slice it. And it's only religion and sectarian conflict which makes countries split. US, no matter how you cut it, is always going to be fairly homogeneous. No matter what rhetoric you see on social media and on 24/7 television, it's ultimately, it's a very homogenized country. No matter where you are in the US, you walk into a Starbucks, it's the same Starbucks. This is not the case in India, of course. In India, every place is its own unique flavor. That's not the case in the US. Of course, there's some difference. You know, people will say, okay, the Texan accent, the Southern accent, you know, something about New York, something about Boston. But it's still, these are nuances. Most people will not even notice it. Most people outside the culture will not even get the difference between a New York, between a guy from New York or a guy from, I mean, there's a New Jersey accent way of speaking. But anyways, there's not much of a difference. So no, I don't think they'll ever secede. Secession, as I said, happens only when there is sectarian conflict and deep-rooted sectarian conflict lasting for centuries. America doesn't have that. Third is, what is the reason for the continued popularity? And this guy said it, I didn't. Third-rate actor like Salman Khan. Well, you see, this comes to the core of something which, again, I've discussed before is, it's that Satyajit Ray versus Manmohan Desai question that I grew up with. It was a standard staple topic of conversation between uncles when I was growing up. Is that, and then I think it's a very interesting conversation that what is art? So when you say third rate actor, who decides what rating it is? So I guess this is coming from a notion of aesthetics, from a notion of, but aesthetics is again a subjective evaluation made by some people. For most people, he's a first-rate actor. And that's why they go to watch his movies. I don't think they consider him to be an actor, but he's a personality. So popularity is essentially how much, to me, over the years, is essentially becoming how popular are you in terms of how much money do you make. That's really the only objective criterion for whether somebody is first-rate or second-rate or third-rate. Now, for me, I obviously, personally, and that's, I will consume, I don't watch Salman Khan movies anymore. I used to, because for me, I just don't enjoy it anymore. At this age where every day brings me closer to death, I don't want to spend my time watching Salman Khan movies anymore. There was a time when I did. I maybe enjoyed it more. I enjoyed it more because I hadn't been exposed to alternatives. I didn't have the alternatives and I didn't know they existed. But now that I know they do, no, that's not what I'm going to be doing. But again, I would hesitate calling someone. I mean, I would possibly do it informally, but I would hesitate to call any work of art to be first rate, second rate, third rate. It's either something which works for you or something which doesn't work for you. And from an objective basis, the only thing is who makes the most money. That's really the only thing that matters, because money is needed in order to make your next work of art. Is Squid Game the greatest South Korean drama ever made? I don't think so. But it's definitely made the most amount of money. So, Vikram Mohan asks, the Modi Twitter hack is worrying. Do you think this will at least prompt the government to look at cybersecurity as a matter of national security? Of course, no. But really cares. By the way, most of these Twitter hacks aren't hacks either. Whether it is Suresh Raina's nephew or whoever it was who hacked into Waqar Yunus' account to like that video. It's not that. But again, I just don't think that. And the Modi Twitter hack was possibly real. And again, I'm saying, your theories on how this could have happened, I don't know. I'm always a little bit hesitant on, like, not everything is a hack, okay? If you get a call from a number which says, your computer has been infected with a virus, call this number, and you call that number, and that person, and it's answered by a person who asks you to install TeamViewer on your computer, and they get access to your computer and install malware on it. I wouldn't consider that to be hacking. That's fraud. I would call the log4j vulnerability, that's hacking, using that. So, but coming back to the question, no, I honestly don't think that the government in India just doesn't have the vision. We hear a lot about IT and we hear a lot about digital payments, but there is really very little in terms of cybersecurity protections, very little in terms of data protection. And I'm talking about not just general policies about data protection, but actual technical controls. For instance, HIPAA has a set of technical controls that are mandated by law for years. I don't see anything in the Indian space, and I don't think that there is anybody with the political heft to, maybe Shashi Tharoor, if this was a Congress government, to even have an interest in these matters. We still, and this is possibly the most disappointing thing for me, is that we still, you know, about 80% of the nation's bandwidth is still Hindu versus Muslim, Hindu versus Muslim, Hindu Muslim. There's virtually nothing substantial, or substantial, I'm not saying there's no policy, but there's nothing substantial on policy. And this is just too esoteric. You can't win an UP election on cybersecurity policy. Ergo, nobody cares. The next question is, how do you see metaverse becoming? These questions, in fact, from one thing to another, like rapid context switches. I have still to see a Gunda question here. How do you see metaverse becoming a part of our lives in 10 years from now? So unlike, you know, cryptocurrency, which I'm kind of a skeptic, that could be because of my age, because I'm generally a skeptical person. The metaverse, I do believe. And what do I mean by metaverse? I mean the notion of decoupling your physical identity from your online identity. That's really the way I like to define it. So right now, of course, you have anonymous accounts spewing venom online. And so you would not know who the real person is. So that's one kind of decoupling, right? But it's mostly the interface is text. And that's really what the internet has been. What the metaverse, or at least what the promise of metaverse is, that it is a much more immersive way of doing it. So now you won't actually, you'll also be virtually be punching the guy in the face, to extend that analogy. And this year I bought myself an Oculus Rift 2, one of those VR headsets, just to see what it was about. First of all, I can't wear it for more than 10 minutes. I mean, I start feeling kind of pukey. Again, blame it on my age. But it's amazing. I mean, it doesn't do a lot, I would say. It's essentially an optical illusion. But the level of immersiveness, I was playing this game, Walking Dead Saints and Sinners. And I've been gaming for years, but the very notion of, like, you have a zombie in front of you and you have a axe. You take the axe from behind and you hit the person, and you know how far that person is. You can hit the person with an axe and the axe can bounce off the skull. Okay, you take a dagger, which is here, and you put it in. And it's not just a question of pressing on the controller, no. The dagger has to hit at the right angle. You have to really push it in order for the zombie to die. So this kind of interaction with the environment, obviously, was hitherto not possible. So this, I believe, is definitely going to, and now, but again, everything that I was playing is just single person. Now think of, and I don't think we maybe not be at the computational power that we need for a headset to have this level of computation power. But Moore's Law, we know that 5 years down the line, this will not make any sense. But essentially, to have multiplayer content where real time you can. And another thing about the metaverse right now is that, again, the computational power, you cannot render realistic environment. But if you can render realistic environment in the way you can do in, let's say, PS5, and you can have actual online personas appear within that virtual reality, that I think is a very exciting thing, and definitely where the world, I would say, is heading. And I mean, again, this is just random guy saying this on YouTube, but I think that this is where Zuckerberg possibly has made his bet right in the metaverse, and, you know, to naming his company Meta. Again, there's a lot of questions on books. The recency bias, the books I read this year, I've been reading a lot of Japanese mystery and I've really enjoyed it. So there's this book I read called Inugami Clan Murders. I might not be getting the name right. Dekagon House Murders. Go and Google Japanese murder mysteries. They're just amazing. I read Numbers Don't Lie from Vaclav's Mill. I read Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me. I read James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time. One book I really liked this year was Joshua Greene's Moral Tribes. Again, if you like this kind of book about, like, why do we do the things we do, I would strongly recommend that. And so more Sunil Kumar says, how much do you attribute success of book to podcast success? I believe it played a role. And all I have to say is this podcast is a success. Moving on. USG88 asks, what goes into making your unique brand of humor? There's a tendency to get all linked in here and start blowing my own trumpet. But I think the only thing that's unique about my brand of humor, if it exists, is the fact that it indeed is myself. I don't say anything just because I know that it will get me likes. I try to be myself with all its flaws in whatever I say. Now, obviously, I was much more free when I was in 2010 when I wrote Me Here, because there was no cancel culture in those days. And once I become old and I stop caring for these things, I will just say, you know what, cancel me, who cares? But I'm not at that stage right now. So I kind of have dialed back on my humor because of that. But even then, whatever I say is very difficult nowadays to say anything against, for instance, Virat Kohli online without subjecting yourself to the vilest of abuse. But I still go ahead and do it because I think that's what I feel and I need to say it. And not be intimidated and cowed down by Mr. Kohli and his huge band of fans. Gajor says, are the engineers taking over the world's big companies? Some tech companies, as I have said before in my podcast, there are very few companies which are engineer-driven. Google is one of them, Facebook is one of them. Microsoft is one of them, but most companies aren't engineer driven at all. I mean, engineers, there's a glass ceiling for all engineers. It's driven by people who make sales. That's really weird. So I don't think that as a rule that engineers will take over the world. Even Amazon, I would say, they have make a lot of money, so everybody gets a lot of money, but I wouldn't call Amazon to be AWS portion. Yes, maybe, but AWS is a part of Amazon. It's not Amazon. Right. So we sometimes in the tech think that AWS is Amazon, but Amazon is essentially a dukan. So in that kind of a place, it's never the engineers are providing support capability. They're not actually the guys making sales. So power, obviously, the closer you are to the last mile of your product, where your product is going to the customer, bigger is your power inside the company, bigger is your leverage. So ultimately, I think always that most companies will be run by people in sales and marketing. There's no doubt about it in my mind. So Rohit Chakraborty says, over the years, have the shifting of Indian minds, especially once around less than equal to 40 years. It's been a few years now that I have been less than equal to 40 years. Increased to US or remained constant? I have no way of knowing. I don't have the data for this because this is almost a data question. Why do Indians succeed more outside the country, apart from a big population being a reason? So I think Indians succeed more outside the country just because there's a different environment, right? And this is, again, this is not rocket science. In India, there is a deeply entrenched culture of bureaucracy and tu janta hai mera baap kaun hai, and essentially privilege is institutionalized. You come in with your privilege to work and your privilege essentially drags you on in work, up and up and up. And that's its merit. We like to say the word merit a lot, but it's never been a meritocracy in India. And that's really what happens when people come outside the country. They're exposed. It's not that they become different individuals. It's just that different areas of their brains are unlocked. When they say, wait, what? I don't have to suck up to my boss. I don't have to go to his house on the weekend and arrange for his kid's birthday party. That's okay. Once these things start happening, I think just people just become better. And they not only do they realize it themselves, but they don't then expect their underlings to do it to their kid's birthday party. So it works both ways. I think that's what actually liberates the Indian mind once they move out of the country. That's one of the reasons. Second is, I think things are changing in India also. I think that some of the newer companies, because people are moving back from the outside the country to India, and they're realizing that, look, this old Sarkari Nokri kind of thing no longer works. You can't make money out of it. But I still think there's a generation to go before we catch up on that. But I think it's encouraging. I think things are much better in India than it was in the 70s, 80s, 90s, or even in the early 2000s. So next question is, and possibly very relevant in the last week, is where do you draw the line with freedom of speech, hate speech, fake news, incitement, personal abuse? If the line has to be drawn, who gets to draw it? Big tech with their left biases, or governments with terrible track records on free speech, especially their criticism? Again, hours of conversation can happen. And there's no good answer. But the line with freedom of speech is that anytime, ultimately, my line on free speech is very high. So, but there is this notion of context, which we all know, that the same thing said here, said in one context A, is perfectly not okay in context B. So, for instance, one of my previous podcasts, I said that you can say a lot of things in a stand-up comedy because, you know, once you're in, when you're on the stage or when you're in the audience, there is an implied contract that I am here to be offended, pushed, taken out of my comfort zone. When you walk into your office, that's not true. That's not true at all. So you can't say a lot of things there. You can't say a lot of things at work. You can't do a lot of things at work. And that's absolutely perfectly fine. So there, academia, for instance, it used to be a place where, again, you could be pushed. You were supposed to be pushed. You were supposed to be pushed intellectually. But now there is safe spaces, trigger warnings, and all the other shit. So I think hate, again, you can say hate speech. Well, hate speech on what? What is hate speech? Hate speech for me, and this comes back to the Haridwar issue, is like when you're essentially saying kill people, I think that's a line. That's a line. That's no longer your opinion. That's the start of something. Now, it could be that nobody kills anybody based on that. And that's fine. And this, you can say that the objectionable act is the killing, not somebody saying go and kill someone. And I get that, but that's not true. Because the line is very blurred when you're essentially saying, this is not a question of criticism. This is not a question of metaphorical criticism. This is not a question of bad criticism. This is not a question of, you know, shaking the foundations of somebody's faith. I get that. This is a question of just go ahead and kill these people. Okay, these people have no right to be in this country or no right to exist. That, to me, is hate speech. And yes, it's not a question of big tech. It's a question of the government. And obviously, the Uttar Pradesh government, when you have that video of the policemen laughing with those guys, it's... The first thing is, again, that we are seeing this now, but this has always been there. It's not, oh, look at what Modi has brought. This kind of hate speech has always been there. It's just that cell phone cameras are new. And these people actually want themselves to be recorded because this is the way to get social media capital for them. I remember that whole Tapush Pal, who was a Trinamool Congress MP, who had made these, hate speech. But the thing with Tapush Pal was that he didn't know that he was being recorded. He was from a different age and he thought that he could just go ahead and say it because he'd been saying it for years and everybody had been saying it, except that that time he got recorded on a, you know, cheap little camera, and that was very embarrassing for him. He never recovered from that. But what I would say in Tapush Pal's case was at least there was some shame. At least there was some sanction. It's not that anything happened to him. It wasn't that he was like arrested, but at least people said it was hate speech. At least he apologized. He hid in his house. He didn't come out. And, you know, he kind of withdrew into a shell. At least there was some effect. With these guys, there is none. They actually are reveling in this notoriety. And it won't happen. We know that there won't be any sanction because it's Uttar Pradesh just before the election. And this has always gone on. So I'm not the person who's going to say that, look, this is this is what's happened because of the poisonous politics of the BJP. No, guess what? This has been there for ages. And I've grown up in Bengal. I haven't seen religious, this kind of a religious schism here in Bengal. But I've heard, I mean, myself walking to college, I've heard like political speeches. You stood and you listened to them because they were like full of hate and personal attacks of the kind, like in today, if there was a cell phone camera and these people were captured saying this, this would be all over the news. So people said that all the time. People enjoyed it then too. This was mostly for rabble rousing, but people said insane stuff. If anything, I think people don't say so much insane stuff nowadays because they always know that they're being recorded. In those days, I mean, CPM rallies, I mean, the government was CPM. They could just say anything they wanted about anybody. Nobody was going to. And so this is not just a question of, you know, Uttar Pradesh. But yeah, this is Uttar Pradesh. This is before elections. Everybody knows that these guys are extremely powerful. So nothing is going to happen to them. And this is tragic, of course. There's not a justification for that. Just because, you know, just because something's been happening for decades doesn't mean that it's right. But it's not also novel. Next question. Man, there's a few questions since it's already 40 minutes now. So do you take notes from books you read? Any system for personal knowledge management? No, I don't take any books, whatever, any notes, whatever goes here. Views on J.K. Rowling controversy. Summarizing my views on J.K. Rowling controversy, it's that once you sail on the boat of wokeness, you will sink. So J.K. Rowling used to be the wokest of the wokes, but guess what? There will always be somebody who will be more woke than you. And in this game of ideological purity, you will fall, no matter who you are. And this is a problem with any kind of fundamentalist philosophy. There is always going to be, this is not just a question of wokeness, it's a question of any kind of religion. If you subscribe to a moral code and if you call out other people on it, guess what? Someday you will be called out because things will always shift to the extreme. So that's why I'm a centrist. It doesn't really matter what your specific drug is. You are not going to come out of this looking well. And that's exactly what's happened to J.K. Rowling. He's a person who I admire greatly as an author, by the way. A views on separation of art from artist. I absolutely agree with it. But in that the art and the artist should be separated. But in this day of social media and specifically the way publishers and people are sold because of the artist. And ultimately, it becomes very difficult sometimes to make a distinction. I wouldn't say that, I mean, I think I can still, even if I was somebody who was greatly appalled by what J.K. Rowling said, by the way, which I don't agree with what she said. But anyways, if I was appalled by it, I don't think that that would fundamentally change my opinion on the Harry Potter world, because there's always been a little bit of a level of distinction between J.K. Rowling, the author, at least in my mind, because when I'm reading it, I'm not imagining J.K. Rowling, I'm imagining Harry Potter and I'm imagining Hermione Granger. But with respect to, let's say, Michael Jackson's music, you don't have that distinction, right? It's his voice, it's his face. And once you see that documentary on Michael Jackson, I mean, it's just, he's a terrible person. How can I, after that, how can I hear this song and how can I lionize him? That's the problem. And that's where the art and the artist becomes blurred. So again, there's no hard and fast rule. In J.K. Rowling's case, I can make that distinction. With Michael Jackson, I possibly can't because of the more intrinsic connection between the art and the artist when it's something like songs. This is his voice, right? Then there's a question of your views on Pant and Rahane asking Kambli's advice for the South Africa tour. I don't know, man. No opinion on that. BN asks, is Log4j the online COVID? Will it be as beneficial for Indian tech as Y2K? No, of course not. It'll be fixed very, be fixed soon. It's something, it's a problem which will fester. Many people are not exposed to it because they didn't even update to the version, which is Log4j version 2. They still run like 1.x version. So again, this is a very fundamental, again, I don't want to get into the, I have a LinkedIn post for those of you on LinkedIn, where I explained it was oversimplification, but I tried to explain what Log4j was. Hamsa asks, is MOOC changing the educational landscape in India with innovative and practical approach? There's no thoughts really on this at this point of time. I'm going to skip a few of them. One person asks, what your qualification? My qualification, a PhD in computer science from Stony Brook. And I specialize in software architecture and cybersecurity. That's my qualification. It also used to be, you know, teach at one point of time, but it's a very passive aggressive question. Significance of Miss Universe in 2021? None. Great answer. Short. None. I don't even know why we are having this. I mean, this is just a audition for the next Mahesh Bhatt movie. That's the way I look at it. It's just, they should just call it what it is, the next Mahesh Bhatt heroine audition. Thoughts on Osho? Never read him. Never quite got it. Saw the documentary. No. Not philosophically, no. What happened to the birthday podcast with Ask Arna Bray? This one. I've been speaking for a while now. M. Sharma asks, if life begins at 40, where are we ghosting the world for 39 years? This is idiotic. Life doesn't begin at 40. Life begins at the day you are currently in. So for me, life begins today. That's the thing with life. You get to choose where the starting point is. So for me, that whole life begins at 40, life begins at 30. Life begins when you want it to. When your life ends is not up to you, but when life begins, when I mean life as in life, it's yours, your choice. Why are people predicting the outcome of elections of 2024 and 2021? I think the answer is that's what prediction is. You usually predict in the future, not here. I understand the question. Three, do you think the length of PM's beard has an impact on voter turnout? Again, data-driven question. Do not have the data for that. And four, ban news of celebrity nuptials. Yes, no. No, don't ban anything. If there's a market for something, there's a market for it. You don't have to be the market for it. Fundamental thing of being a centrist. If you don't like something, doesn't mean it's bad. If you don't like Hindu majoritarian politics, that's good. But that doesn't mean it's evil. That doesn't mean because it's not evil because every religion has its majoritarian politics. So there is, try to not have value judgments. And I have value judgments myself, by the way. But I'm saying that I want to go to a place where I don't make value judgments. Just because something is something which I do not approve of does not necessarily make it Nazism. Just because I don't like Salman Khan's movies doesn't necessarily make him a third-rate actor. That's the point that I'm trying to make. In my opinion, on my priorities in my life, yeah, he's way below. But if he rocks your boat, if Bhai Ka Picture Laga Hai is like makes you get up from your deathbed, perfectly fine. Sanket Shinoy asks, will 2024 be Biden versus Trump, a fight of 40-year-old dudes? I don't think that Biden will be running in 2024. I think the Democrats will possibly field a more progressive candidate. It makes sense for them. Elon Musk, is he Tony Stark, Lex Luthor, or Jacob Fugger? I don't know who he is, by the way, the last guy. But Elon Musk is, you know, of course, he's a very smart guy. I mean, again, I don't know whether he's a genius, but he's definitely a very smart guy. Anybody who, you know, becomes the richest man in the world, I think he's the richest man in the world, not Jeff Bezos at this point, if I'm not sure. He's definitely a smart guy. But I think what I like about him is that he kind of engages with people. He's online, he's trolling, he's like, he's unguarded. He's unlike any other mega rich guy that we have seen. Because mega rich people at that level don't have opinions. They can't afford to have opinions because they're afraid that they will piss people off. But he doesn't care. He doesn't care if he's having a troll battle with an US politician who might be a president one day. He doesn't care. You wouldn't find Jeff Bezos taking on, let's say, a Trump direct. He would take it to proxies. But the great thing about Elon Musk is he doesn't use proxies. And whether you like him or you hate him, he is himself. And I appreciate and applaud that. Again, do I like him? I think there is a kind of cult around him. And I think he knows how to play that cult, like any cult leader. But I think he's definitely a very smart guy. In that case, I would say he's more Tony Stark than he's Lex Luthor. Now comes the gunda questions. I hate gunda questions. Even though my birthday cake was a gunda thing, at this point, I'm just tired about talking about gunda because, you know, conversations of gunda inevitably lead to a trivialization of everything else that I say. That this guy is only good for gunda. So I just don't even want to. And it's been flogged to death, really. Would you be fine to be the guide if one wants to do a PhD thesis on gunda? And the answer to it is no, absolutely not. I do not want to do it. Somebody asked me, what was your rank in West Bengal joint in West Bengal high secondary education? Vivek Tripathi. This question was I haven't been asked this question for a long time. And this question was usually a question which, I didn't go through the whole arranged marriage thing, but this was a question, I think the last time that people normally encountered this question, Bengalis isn't dealing in arranged marriage. So I tweeted the answer is, in West Bengal joint, my rank was 103, and in West Bengal high secondary, my rank was 27. I'm going to ignore what is your favorite book. So obviously, I've said it, Mahabharat, one book, it will obviously be Mahabharat. What is your favorite Bengali movie? Which one is your favorite Satyajit Ray movie? It's very difficult to choose. Today, I will at least say, maybe it's Opu Shangsha. Rishabh Pandey asks, Nation wants to know how you feel when you get tagged for Arnab Goswami. I find it idiotic. Idiotic. At one point of time, I used to find it amusing, but now I just find it, why would you think I'm Arnab Goswami when my name is not Goswami? Why would you think so? I might have a... And Arnab Goswami's lost weight also. So he doesn't look like me either. So I just don't get it. I mean, read my name. Okay. Before you give me an opinion, read my name. It's not Goswami. Rishabh Pandey asks, why is Bollywood not able to create cinema of same quality as the gloriously cheesy 80s and 90s? It's because Bollywood is... The fundamental change of Bollywood from it used to be a family-driven industry. I mean, most of the people were the Chopras and the Johars, and it was family. It was driven by, you know, few people. So what you basically saw was what they felt you needed to see. It's moved from that to essentially suits and ties and people with MBA degrees, and those people still have control, but it's kind of changed. That, I think... The audience has changed. So I think that if you have, let's say, the kind of movies, I mean, Elane Jung, nobody would want to watch Elane Jung in these days because it's just for the new audience. I mean, who watches Hindi movies? It's not people for my age. It's like younger people. Their tastes have changed. Nobody wants to watch them. There's just so much options. So I understand that. And then, of course, there is, of course, wokeness. There's stuff which you can't say, which you can't do. There is social media has made people essentially afraid. And people would say that's a good thing. Maybe it is. But they're just afraid of things that they can say and they can't say. And that wasn't the case in the 80s. I mean, here's a test. If you have old Stardust episodes, just Stardust or Filmfare issues, just go through the statements that people used to make in those days in print and imagine them saying those things. Well, those guys are still alive and many of them are on social media still. And the stuff they say now, and the stuff they used to say then. Just notice the difference between the two, and you'll know what I'm talking about. The same guy. That guy feels what he used to say in the 80s, in the 90s, without any filter. And now they're all so good and nice. But So I think that's one of the reasons. Because I don't think that they've fundamentally changed, but they've taken their hands off. Maybe it's a good thing. Again, I'm not passing a value judgment here. I love the cheesy 80s and 90s movies because, again, I'm not going to seriously say that they were great movies. I like them because they were a reflection of myself at a point of time. When I see Mohra, I'm not watching it because it's not like I'm watching friggin' Battleship Potemkin. Okay, I enjoy Mohra because I can see, when I look at Mohra, I see myself as I used to be. When I first watched Mohra, it's like me looking into this time portal back at myself, and my brain triggers the exact same emotions. That's why I love Mohra. I don't love Mohra because it's a very aesthetically pleasing movie. Okay, Mohra is actually a decent movie, I would say. But Gupta, let's say. Okay, Gupta also is a fairly decent movie. I don't know what I'm saying. Dilwale Dulhaniya Le Jayenge. It's a movie which if I take out my college romance thing and I just watch it dispassionately, I don't think I can sit through it anymore. Again, a question on Dream Team from current lot for remaking Gunda. Bhai, maaf kijiye, ye sab mere se nahi hoga. Varun Gautam says, coronavirus kab jayega? If I knew, then I would be investing in like Bitcoin. I would be investing. If I had such a crystal ball into the future, I don't think, if you really ask me, I don't think coronavirus will go anywhere. It'll become endemic. We're going to have so many waves. I hope that the virus will basically evolve up into something which is just, and will be dealt with like a flu virus every year we'll have, or every 6 months we'll have a booster shot. I think that's really how it's going to resolve itself. Another question from Varun Gautam, jinhe meme banana nahi, meme banana ya Photoshop karna na aata ho, kya wo Twitter user Twitter par aaj bhi successful ho sakte hain? Dude, I'm last guy to ask. I think it's not a question of meme or Photoshop anymore. It's a question of how extreme your opinions are. That's really all that matters. It's the more extreme you are, the more solid your fan base becomes. And that's really the key to the success. That or doing dances on TikTok. This is off topic from the usual questions. Thank you. I mean, there was really no topic. How do you see the disastrous effect the school closures had on young children for the 2 years? More defined is the problem rural schools where the parents will be illiterate. Yes, absolutely. The thing about coronavirus, whenever at least I think of coronavirus, I always think of in terms of myself. I don't think of in terms of people like who are not like myself. So I think that, but unlike many, I am for school closures. I am when I don't think now with the vaccines, with children getting vaccinated, I don't think it's true anymore. But I was in favor of school closures because of the need to protect the more vulnerable. I don't think it was a problem with children, but the fact that children could carry it home, and children are usually the biggest vectors of disease because they go everywhere. They don't wash their hands. They fight in the mud. So, of course, and what they would expose their parents to and their grandparents to. And I felt that the cost of the mental health, I totally understand the mental health implications, but you know, if your parents die, it's not good for you either. So that's the cost here. That's the cost benefit. I don't think there's any easy choice here. So Sima asks, considering all the turmoils of the current world, not least of them the rise of, shall I say, fascist China. Don't say fascist China. And the moral decline of the liberal US. What do you think is the future of real liberalism? I don't know. I just don't think there will be any real liberalism. Again, this is not China and US. It is social media, which has killed nuance. If every time, for instance, let me take a very non-political thing. If every time I say anything against Virat Kohli and I have to fear for essentially quasi-death threats, let's just not say it. That's the problem. And I don't have supporters, by the way. Since when I say anything against Kohli, I'm not saying Rohit Sharma is God. So I'm not getting the Rohitian army to come and support me. If I did, then that's fine. There is this Rohitian versus Kohlian thing going on all over the interwebs. And that's fine. And that's really what the death of liberalism is that. The death of liberalism is not by the agency of any country. It is through the collective bullying behavior of the net, where you yourself are individually powerless, but as long as you can attach yourself to a larger collective, that's when you can truly be powerful. And anybody who does not want to attach themselves consistently to a collective and wants to judge and evaluate issues on the basis of their merits, first of all, that person is not going to be popular, that person is not going to be successful, and that person stands to lose a lot. That's where liberalism will die. It's not one person, it's a group behavior that will kill liberalism. Next question, what is your biggest success? My biggest success is my daughter. Simple answer. Biggest failure, I'm not going to say it here. Come on, I'm not going to give pleasure to my trolls and to my lurkers as to what my biggest failure is. I like to say, if you ask me the biggest failure is KKR buying Mashtafa Murtaza for 600 and so on. My biggest failure, but the biggest failure I've seen in my life. But yeah, I've failed much more than I've succeeded. Happy? Biggest regret? Biggest regret would be that I did my PhD. That would be my biggest regret. I have many regrets. That would be my biggest regret, that I did my PhD, that I came to the US. Maybe I should have stayed in India, done a MBA, because that's the kind of person I am. I should have been more on the marketing and, you know, the marketing business development side than the technical side. I think that's where I would have possibly been more happy. And I didn't take that path. I'm not a very academic type. And I think that's my biggest regret. I mean, I have strong opinions on PhD in general, but I also feel that I wasn't a particularly good fit for a PhD in computer science. I mean, it's not that I didn't get anything out of it. I did. But if I could do things over again, that's the thing which I definitely would not do, with the benefit of hindsight, of course. Varun Agarwal asks, Arnabda, I've been following your blog for over a decade now. I absolutely love it. But in the last few years, it has become remarkably dark. Are you feeling down? What do you do to cheer up? Is writing therapeutic or a source of worry? It's my birthday today, so I'm not going to answer this question. But yeah, there've been some stuff that's happened over the last few years that's kind of made me a bit more reflective and a little bit more disappointed in life in general and people in general. So again, choose not to think about it. At least not for today. Ikigai, have you struggled with meaning of life and what were your reflections? Man, these questions are really hitting me from different parts. How do you motivate yourself to go through the daily journey? The thing about and I'm not saying that I have succeeded, but I'm working towards it, is to enjoy where I am. The easiest way to understand joy is what happens when a toothache goes away. You feel happy. But we don't feel happy when every day we don't get up and say, we don't have a toothache. Wow, it's a great day. I asked a question online, how was your year? And unequivocally, the answer was, I had a terrible year. But did you? Did you have a terrible year? I'm pretty sure you do feel you had a terrible year. But did you really? The fact that you're alive, the fact that you're typing an answer to this tweet, the fact that I'm hoping that you don't have any physical pain or ailment, that's a privilege. So what I tried, and again, it's not that I can think like this, but I want to. I want to appreciate everything that I have now that I can't see, but I know exists. And so I have tried to move away from a goal-based thinking of happiness. I need to be here. I need to be a full-time author, which I know that I'll never be able to. So I've stopped struggling with things that I know I will not get, things which I cannot control, and things which are determined by factors that I honestly have no control over, and try to think more in terms of the immediate pleasure. So before, as an example, there are many times when I didn't want to write a blog, but I just said, no, I have to write a blog. I have to create my brand as an author. You know, people will comment. People are expecting my opinions. People are emailing me. They're saying, Arnav, what are you, do you think? I have to answer. I have to write. Now I say, you know what? Screw it. I don't feel like writing. I might not feel like writing for months. And you know what? It's perfectly fine. I'm going to watch Netflix. I'm going to watch Amazon Prime. Because it's my seconds. It's not yours. It's my life. It's my time. And I will spend it the way I want. And this to me has become like there's several times in my life where people ask me, can you do this for me? And like, could be anything. Like, can you be a guest speaker at something? And I didn't want to do it, but I thought, man, if I don't do it, maybe this is the thing. Maybe I do this and then, you know, things take off and people really like it. Now if I don't want to do it, I just say, nope, sorry, sir, not doing it. I actually like saying no sometimes because I say, you know, I get offers to, can we collaborate on a script? Can we do this? And a few years ago, I would think, yeah, well, I can't say no to this guy. We should collaborate on a script. What if this thing takes off? What if this is my ticket to fame? Now I realize, you know what? No, it could be. I don't care. Not feeling like it. I'm not going to do it. Abhilash Mukherjee asks, what is your point of view on the Indian startup scene of unicorns skyrocketing paychecks and venture capital fundings? Again, short answer. Short answer to this is, I think much of startup scene, not about Indian startup scene, but startup scene in general, it's a pyramid, it's a Ponzi scheme. it's people, glib people, well-connected people, creating a good story, selling it to another group of people who are then selling that, repackaging that story as a story to somebody else. And ultimately, there will be people who will be left holding the bill. I am not convinced. I mean, again, I'm not going to pretend to be an expert. Many of the unicorns, to me, make no sense. I mean, essentially, people pay them a huge amount of money to get users, whatever the product is, and they spend an insane amount of money to get the users, which is then used to get the next round of funding, which creates another cycle of user acquisition. And that's, again, this is the basis of a Ponzi scheme. And at the end, somebody is left holding the bill, because obviously you cannot continuously keep on buying users and hemorrhaging. And so ultimately somebody gets the bill. That's for me. That's the way I look at it. Are there questions on UP and Punjab elections? Not going there. Will you do an episode exclusively on Succession? I might do it. Which books do you read this year? No more books. Can a Bengali person be vegetarian? These are the questions I like. They can be. A lot of Bengali vegetarian people. I don't know where this question comes from. How do you find News Laundry's coverage of the Bengal elections? I don't know. Top three books, top three movies. There was a question on this person who made a comment calling diaspora in US termites. I don't know. This is, again, one more thing that I'm trying to move forward. It's just this random outrage based on random individuals. Okay, somebody thinks I'm a termite. As long as they don't come to my house with a bighorn and try to, I'm perfectly fine. Again, this is a problem if this person is a person of power, if that's true. But I'm trying to move beyond like isolated outrage over some random person on the internet saying something. Why? I mean, that's this is and this is my protest almost against like this kind. I mean, once you do this, that's exactly brings about more and more extreme opinions. If the reason why people say many things, I'm not saying this specific case, but it's just to get a rise out of people. And that's really what works. If you're a person who's nuanced, trying to make a for and against judgment, trying to talk about principles, first of all, nobody has the, God damn it, nobody has the bandwidth to even understand what you're saying. I'm not going to spend more than 2 seconds on what you're trying to say. So if you're going to start off with nuance, screw you. I'm going to go to somewhere else. But if you say termites, that's it. Point's been made, right? So this is, again, whether it be those guys in Haridwar or anybody, I think this desire to trigger a response. So I'm trying to, the only way that one can say this, not to be triggered yourself. Say, okay, fine. You think I'm a termite, that's fine. Finally, I think that's the final question that I'll be answering here. And there's another question which I just got. If not Modi, who else, BJP or otherwise? Pratap Bhanu Mehta wrote this piece on this, the Tina, there's no alternative on Modi. So I don't know who's, I mean, again, the short answer is we don't vote for people, we vote for parties. But also, it's also not true. Everybody votes. As I've said before, voting is an intensely, nobody votes based on data, nobody votes on performance, people vote on the connection to an individual. It used to be Indira Gandhi for many years, and it is Modi now. It's always Modi versus Kejriwal versus Mamata. It's never really party philosophies, agenda, nobody cares. But other than Modi, I don't think, I mean, as I said, Yogi Adityanath is the next Modi. I think he's following a very similar trajectory, you know, chief minister of a state, religious polarization, then he'll become a prime minister, will possibly pivot to the center. I don't think that people can kind of be extreme. Again, when I say extreme, I'm not saying what they personally feel, but their public persona. I don't think they can be if they're the prime minister. They shouldn't be. And in terms of an alternative, there's always an alternative. Again, it's not a question of alternative to a person. It's always, I feel, there's an alternative to a party. I think the main problem is, the real question is that everybody is the same. That's really the problem. That the question isn't that there is not an alternative to Modi, or there's an alternative to Rahul Gandhi, or not an alternative to Mamata Banerjee, but there's no real alternative to the current political system. And the flaw of this isn't just an India problem, it's a problem in the US. It's a problem of any place which has a democracy. And I'll again come back to Plato. Plato saw all of this stuff, and he centuries ago. And he basically said that, you know, any system where you can basically get elected by pandering to the basest instincts of humankind, that's not a particularly good system. And just like you would never go to a doctor, they would never cure your ailment by asking 100 doctors as to what ailment you have and then taking a, you know, seeing which is the biggest majority. You wouldn't solve you. You would go to one person whom you trust, whose judgment you trust, who has the background, and then take that and just do it. Why do we have a different standard for our governance than we have for our own personal health? That was the question that Plato had asked. So I think the fault is essentially in the system, and it is, democracy still remains the best system because there is no alternative to democracy. I mean, Plato's alternative to democracy was a paper exercise. It was untenable in the real world, and that's why there's never been really an alternative to democracy. The only other alternative to democracy is something which is even worse, which is China. Anyways, so this has gone on for quite a long time, this podcast, vlog, whatever you want to call it, or however you're consuming this media. The last thing that I wanted to say was, again, for my birthday, the thing that is that as I grow older, and I wouldn't have been saying this when I was 15 or when I was 25, but I realized that coming to a birthday is a privilege. I mean, that's what... It's not so much, you know, what happened, am I where I want to be in my life? The fact that I'm here, the fact that you are seeing me, the fact that I can stand up, that's a privilege. That's something which is worth celebrating. And in these days of COVID and what we've seen this world go through, where you have millions who have died, you know, the very fact that you and me, whoever's watching this video, the fact that you are there, the fact that I'm here, we should celebrate that. We should be happy for that. And of course, shit happens and shit will continue to happen. And the fact, and this is again a thought that I always have on my birthday, that ultimately it's inevitable, we're all walking towards the end. But that's there always, right? The main thing is that I'm here. I'm here right now. I have my mind. I have my thoughts. I have the privilege to be here, to not be worried about the food on my plate or the roof above my head. And I have my health, not at 100%, but okay enough, I would say. That's a privilege. Not a lot of people have it. The people who don't have it were not better than you. They didn't take worse choices than you. The reason why you're here, reason why I am here, is we're just lucky. There's no other word for it. We're just lucky. And I want to close my podcast episode today and the year with just stop for a second and just be happy as to how lucky you are, how lucky I am, and how lucky we are. And we should be happy about this. So, have a happy new year and take care of yourself and of each other. Goodbye.